King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, and set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So, the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials assembled for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before it. Then the herald loudly proclaimed, "Nations and peoples of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace." Therefore, as soon as they heard the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, and all kinds of music, all the nations and peoples of every language fell down and worshipped the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. At this time, some astrologers came forward and denounced the Jews. They said to King Nebuchadnezzar, "May the king live forever. Your Majesty has issued a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music must fall down and worship the image of gold, and that whoever does not fall down and worship will be thrown into a blazing furnace. But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, your Majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." Furious with rage, Nebuchadnezzar summoned Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So these men were brought before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar said to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the image of gold I have set up? Now, when you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, if you are ready to fall down and worship the image I made, very good. But if you do not worship it, you will be thrown immediately into a blazing furnace. Then what god will be able to rescue you from my hand?" Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, "King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your Majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your Majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar was furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and his attitude toward them changed. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times hotter than usual and commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the blazing furnace. So these men, wearing their robes, trousers, turbans, and other clothes, were bound and thrown into the blazing furnace. The king's command was so urgent and the furnace so hot that the flames of the fire killed the soldiers who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, firmly tied, fell into the blazing furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar leaped to his feet in amazement and asked his advisors, "Weren't there 3 men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, your Majesty." He said, "Look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the 4th looks like a son of the gods." Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisors crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their head singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save in this way. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon.
Thank you very much, Ruth. Now, some of you may have seen the movie Dunkirk. That came out a few years ago. This is the movie of the true story of the evacuation of tens of thousands of British, Commonwealth, and European soldiers from some of the beaches of Northern Europe at the start of the Second World War. And that movie was very realistic. But one thing that it missed out was the radio message that started the whole operation off. What happened was that the Nazi armies were beginning to close in, and a British naval officer on the beach messaged back to London. And his message contained only three brief words. And they were the words, but, if not. Now, I can't remember whether that code had been prearranged or not, but he was referring to Daniel chapter 3 and verse 18 in our passage this morning. And he was saying two things. He was saying, we need rescued immediately, but if not, then we are willing to stand and even die if need be. It's a message of great resolution and great bravery. And we can see the original words in verse 17 to 18 of our passage this morning, where these three young men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, say to the king these words: our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. And so, as we'll see later on, those words have some great lessons for us this morning. So then, we're at the time of the exile. We're around 600 BC, where God's people are in exile in Babylon. And we've been following the progress of a small group of Hebrew young men, Daniel and his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, as they seek to remain faithful to God in a foreign land. We've called this series, Where is God in a Changing World? And that was certainly true for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. It seemed like things were constantly changing for them, as it often does for us too. And yet they were able to remain faithful to God with his help, and we can too. So then we're going to look at this story under three headings, and the first of them is a powerful idol. And we can see the idol or the image that King Nebuchadnezzar sets up in verse 1 and 2. King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold, 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, and set it on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. He then summoned the satraps, prefects, governors, advisors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the other provincial officials to come to the dedication of the image he had set up. So let's look at some of the features of this image, and then we'll also draw out some application for ourselves. So first of all, we see its appearance. This image is about 90 feet high, which is roughly the same height as the big Buddha over on Lantau. And it was made of gold and was placed on a plane so that people could see it glittering for miles around. And then anyone who was anyone in the empire was invited to come to a great feast of dedication for it. Now, we're not sure if this image was of Nebuchadnezzar himself or of one of his gods, but either way, there was no doubt about who was behind it. Then we also see the image's purpose. So in verse 4, a herald loudly proclaims, nations and peoples of every language, this is what you are commanded to do. As soon as you hear the sound of the horn, flute, zither, lyre, harp, pipe, and all kinds of music, you must fall down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And so that makes clear that the purpose of this image was worship. You must bow down and worship the image of gold that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Last week, we saw that Nebuchadnezzar responded to Daniel's interpretation of his dream by acknowledging that God was the God of gods and the Lord of kings. And so we may well ask ourselves, what's happened here? Has he forgotten all that? Has he decided to build a great monument instead to bring glory to himself? Well, it seems as if he has. But I think that's also a reminder that it's actually quite common for people to sort of swing backwards and forwards in their views when they're seeking God or are learning more about him. And then part of the purpose of this image was probably also unity. The Babylonian Empire, of course, was very diverse. And so what better way to unite everyone than to have them come and worship a giant image of the emperor? And of course, this is something that totalitarian regimes have often done throughout the years. And then finally, we see its pressure. There must have been enormous pressure to have worshipped this idol. It had been commanded by the king. Everyone who was anyone was doing it, all of the governmental and cultural leaders. And there must have been a great atmosphere with all this music playing. Incidentally, as I was saying in the Sermon Bites this last week, I think that the repetition of all of these instruments and this long list of leaders, which is repeated a number of times, is meant to make this whole occasion just sound a little bit ridiculous. I think he's saying this is really just a lot of fuss and a lot of noise about an empty idol. How foolish! Imagine going to all that trouble for something that is not God. But yet, for those of the people who were there, this was a really serious business. So verse 6 reminds us, whoever does not fall down and worship will immediately be thrown into a blazing furnace. And so we have the image over here, and we have a fiery furnace over here. And so what would you choose? What would you have done if you were there? As one commentator states, the praise band plays, and the crowd gets its backsides in the air and its noses in the sand and enjoys job security. They felt that they had no choice. They had to do it. There's a tremendous invisible coercion that comes from being among a whole mob of flattened worshippers. And I think that that's exactly right. And it's exactly the same in our world too. Idols exert a tremendous pressure on us to bow down to them and conform to them or face the consequences. Now, of course, we could spend lots of time this morning talking about some of the idols that we have here in Hong Kong. Idols like wealth or educational success or pleasure. And that would be absolutely right. Those things are indeed idols and they do exert tremendous pressure on us. But I think that the strongest line of application here is probably to those times when states issue decrees that lead Christians into direct conflict with them. And so there are many totalitarian regimes throughout the world that demand the absolute loyalty of their people in a way that Christians just cannot give. Right now, there are Christians in labor camps in North Korea, for instance, for refusing to give worship to the supreme leader in exactly the same way that King Nebuchadnezzar was demanding it here. In other countries, it's not uncommon for Christians to be stuck in menial jobs, or for their kids to be denied educational opportunities, or for them to be discriminated against simply because they refuse to kowtow to the regime. Here in Hong Kong, we've been blessed with many years of religious freedom, and that's obviously a great thing to give thanks for. But how would we respond if it came to a place where we needed to give absolute loyalty to a leader or an ideology other than Christ? What would we do then? And then we may even be beginning to experience this a little bit in more Western contexts. It's increasingly common for Western governments to ask school teachers, for instance, to teach things about sexuality or gender that most Christian teachers are deeply unhappy with. Here in Hong Kong, there may also be increasingly numbers of company policies that ask Christian bosses to promote things in the workplace that go directly against what they believe from the Bible. There can be all sorts of consequences to that. They're not likely to be thrown into a literal fiery furnace, but they can easily be thrown into the fiery furnace of people's opinions or losing their jobs. Now, of course, none of those things is in quite the same league as what Shadrach, Meshach and Abednego faced here. But you can see how we can begin to see some of these things in our world in some small measure. Now, it might not always be clear how we are to respond. But what would we do? Would we bow down or would we stand firm? Well, that moves us on to the next thing that we see in our story, which is a steadfast faith. And we see this in verse 8. to 18. What did Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do? Well, when the music started, they stayed right where they were. Everyone else put their noses in the sand and their backsides in the air, but yet they remained standing in a minority of three, obvious to everyone. I suppose they could have easily reasoned that they needed to hold onto their jobs for the sake of the other exiles. Or they could have reasoned that they didn't want to appear ungrateful for all that King Nebuchadnezzar had done for them. Wouldn't that be a bad witness to him? Or maybe they could have said, well, I'm only bowing down in my official capacity as a government employee. This is not something that I actually mean inside in my heart. The only reason I'm doing this is because it's in my contract. But actually, they didn't do any of these things. They refused to bow down to the king's image. Why did they do this? Why did they refuse to obey the king? Well, I think that we can see the answer in verse 12 in our passage. So this group of disgruntled court officials come to see the king, and they say to him in verse 12, "But there are some Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who pay no attention to you, your majesty. They neither serve your gods nor worship the image of gold you have set up." So when they say that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do not serve your gods, that's a hint that points us towards the first of the Ten Commandments. So Exodus chapter 20 and verse 3, which says, "You shall have no other gods before me." And then when they say that they will not worship the image of God that you have set up, that points towards the next commandment. So Exodus chapter 20, verse 4, "You shall not make for yourself an image in the form of anything in heaven above, or on the earth below, or in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them or worship them." And so the reason Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do not bow down is not because they're trying to be awkward, but rather it's because of what God has said in his word. It's a question of loyalty to him. The principle is we must obey God rather than men. And so the king calls them in. He asks them if it's true that they are not worshipping his image. And then you see their great confession of faith in verse 16 to 18. This is really the heart of this passage. And so let's remind ourselves of what it says. So verse 16, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to him, 'King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up.'" So they're respectful and humble towards the king, but also brave and courageous. So we see their faith is in two things. First of all, their faith in God's power. They're absolutely convinced that God is able to rescue them. But then they also have faith in God's sovereignty. "But even if he does not, we want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or the image you have set up." They believe that God is able to save them, but they acknowledge that he may not choose to on this particular occasion. If he rescues them, great. If he does not rescue them, then that's also fine. They will continue to be faithful to him and will not obey the king. "We want you to know, your majesty, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold that you have set up." And so really for us, this is a great example of faith. We could summarize their attitude as do the right thing and leave the consequences with God. Do the right thing and leave the consequences with God. We need to obey God no matter what happens, and then leave the consequences with him. As one author has said, our duty is to do what is right. That is it. There is nothing more. If doing right means we are ruined, that is God's affair. Consequences are in his hands, but duty is in ours. Our job in life is to do what pleases him, whatever the cost and whatever the outcome. Our job in life is to do what pleases him, whatever the cost and whatever the outcome. One of the films that I've really enjoyed in the last year is Terrence Malick's A Hidden Life. And this film is based on the true story of an Austrian peasant during World War II who refused to take an oath of loyalty to the Nazi Party in Germany. It's a really moving film, And one of the things that really stands out for me is just the immense pressure that he was under to conform. Virtually everybody around him, including members of his immediate family and even the local priest, was telling him to declare his loyalty to Hitler, but yet he refused and he would not give in. I think that's exactly what we see going on here. We are to do the right thing, regardless of the consequences, even if the consequences, as in the case of that Austrian peasant, were that he ended up being charged with treason. And so what about us? Will we do the right thing, regardless of the consequences? Now, I know that often in my own Christian life, passages like this have really worried me. And my worry is that I'm not sure that I would have the same courage that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. Would I be able to stand firm? Or would it be more likely that I would give in and compromise? But as I've reflected on this, there are at least two things that encourage me. And one is that I need to trust in God's sovereignty. If God ever places me in a situation like this, then I need to trust that he's able to give me the resources that I need to glorify him in it. And surely I can trust him in that. And then number two, what is really important is that I am faithful to him right now. So in one sense, there's really no point in me worrying about what may or may not happen in the future. The important point really is, am I being faithful right now? Am I choosing to obey God right now in the areas where he wants me to? Will I obey God sexually, no matter what the outcome of that may be? Will I fill in my income tax form honestly, even if I end up being poorer than everyone else? Will I be committed to church every week, even although there are so many competing priorities? Will I make God my number one? Well, all of those are just a few of the areas where God might be calling us to be faithful right now, in exactly the same way that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were. Do the right thing now, and then leave the consequences in God's hands. But then what were the consequences of all this? And that moves us on to look at an amazing rescue. So in verse 19, the king is furious with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. His attitude has changed, and now he commands that the furnace be heated up 7 times hotter than usual. In verse 20, he commands his soldiers to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And then in verse 21, wearing their robes, turbans, and finest clothes, presumably for this great feast of dedication, they're thrown into the fiery furnace. In verse 22, we read that the flames are so hot that they kill the men who are throwing them in, thus showing that a megalomaniac leader like Nebuchadnezzar has no regard for human life, and that it does not pay to obey a pagan king. Most likely this furnace would have been some kind of kiln that would have been used for baking bricks, or maybe was used for smelting the gold for the image of Nebuchadnezzar. And so Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego would have been put in the top and then would have sort of fallen down into the flames. All the king was probably expecting was a few brief screams and then quiet. But then actually this amazing dialogue takes place. So we read in verse 24, then King Nebuchadnezzar leapt to his feet in amazement and asked his advisers, "Weren't there 3 men that we tied up and threw into the fire?" They replied, "Certainly, your majesty." And then verse 25, he said, "Look, I see 4 men walking around in the fire, unbound and unharmed, and the 4th looks like a son of the gods." Then we read, Nebuchadnezzar then approached the opening of the blazing furnace and shouted, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here." So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire, and the satraps, prefects, governors, and royal advisers crowded around them. They saw that the fire had not harmed their bodies, nor was a hair of their heads singed. Their robes were not scorched, and there was no smell of fire on them. And so this was a great miracle. We're not quite sure who the 4th person in the fire was. People have often speculated that maybe this was a sort of pre-incarnation appearance of Christ. In verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar seems to think that it was an angel of God. But the reality is that we don't know for sure. However, what we do know is that God was with his people in their suffering for him. There's no guarantee that we will always be rescued when we take a stand for God. This passage is descriptive of what happened to these young men. It is not prescriptive for us, but yet it is a guarantee that God will be with us in the midst of the flames and what we are going through, like he was here. It's possible that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego would have known the wonderful promise of Isaiah 43 that was written before the exile. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not sweep over you. When you walk through the fire, you will not be burned. The flames will not set you ablaze. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Saviour. And then when we come to the New Testament, of course, we see even more clearly that Jesus is with us. In Matthew chapter 28, verse 20, when Jesus sends his disciples out, he says, I am with you always to the very end of the age. And so when we obey God, we can be sure that Jesus is with us. And then no matter what happens now, we can be sure that Jesus will ultimately rescue us. And this really is the great news of the gospel. A moment's reflection will show us that we are not naturally like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We all know that naturally we are those who worship idols. We've all put our backsides in the air and our noses in the sand as far as idols are concerned. And so we rightly deserve God's wrath and his judgment against us. But yet the great news of the gospel is that even in his anger, God remembers mercy. He has sent Jesus Christ into our world as one of us. He lived a perfect life where he was always faithful to God and never once worshipped idols. And he went to the cross for us, there taking our sin and idolatry on himself and offering us the free gift of his faithfulness and his righteousness in its place. And so you see, God is the ultimate rescuer. He may choose to rescue us from the fiery furnace or not, but we know for sure that we can be confident in his ultimate rescue because of Jesus' death for us on the cross. And if you don't know him yet as your rescuer, then you should certainly seek him this morning. For those of us who are Christians already, surely this should vastly increase our faith in him. We know that God is with us, even in our darkest trials, and that even if the worst happens, that he will rescue us and will take us to be with himself. And so there's a great reassurance for us here. If I get the virus, can God heal me? Absolutely. But even if not, we know that when we die, we will go to be with him. And that ought to be something that puts steel in our backbones if we are God's people this morning. You see, this passage reminds us that God is our rescuer, and that is great news. In verse 15, King Nebuchadnezzar says, then what God will be able to save you from my hand? By verse 28, he's able to answer his own question. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Last week, Nebuchadnezzar learnt that God is the God of history, whose kingdom will endure. This week, he has learnt that God is the God who rescues. But he's not there yet. Notice that he still refers to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego rather than call him my God. He's still on the way. Why has he changed his mind? What has Nebuchadnezzar seen? Well, he saw the fourth person in the flames who had come to rescue the young men. But this verse says that more than that, he also saw that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had trusted in God. They had defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve any god except their own. What impressed this pagan king so much was that these three young men were willing to defy him because of their faith in God. And it's a great lesson for us. We're often told that the way to reach our world is to blend in and be exactly like everyone else and compromise as far as we can. And then if we do that, everyone will see how normal we are and will want to become Christians. But if Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had taken that approach, then nothing would have happened. All that would have happened is they would have felt guilty for having disobeyed their God and would have probably been discouraged. Now, of course, obviously, we are not to be awkward or foolish or offhand in the way that we take our stand for Christ. But this is a reminder that it is as we stand out from the world that our effectiveness for God increases. And we see that clearly here in this story. We should strive for that same blend of bravery and humility that characterized Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Do what is right and leave the results with God. And so we have seen a powerful idol, a steadfast faith, and an amazing rescue. Will we stand firm for God this coming week, looking to him for his help and strength? Let's pray together. Father in heaven, we give thanks for this great example of these three young men who stood faithfully for you. In a world where we face so many pressures to compromise, we pray that you would help us to stand firm like they did. Help us to have faith in you, help us to know that you are with us, and help us to be confident of our ultimate rescue through Christ. And we ask all of these things now in Jesus' name. Amen.